The Arthropod. The Arthropod is the home for the wonderful, weird, wacky world of insects. Hosted by Jonathan Larson, Jody Green, and Michael Scavarla.
Welcome back, everybody, to Arthropod, your entomology podcast. I am but one of your entomological hosts for the day, Jonathan Larson of the University of Kentucky.
I'm another one of your hosts. I'm Jody Green. I work for the University of Nebraska-Lincoln.
And I'm the last host today, Michael Scavarla of Penn State University.
And we are joined by a very special guest, a PhD graduate student who works with bed bugs that I'm going to let introduce herself. Special guest, can you let the Arthropod crowd know who you are?
Hi, guys. I'm Morgan Wilson. I am a research technician and graduate student at Virginia Tech.
Welcome aboard, Morgan. We are happy to have you here. I hope that you haven't brought any bed bug samples with you or anything. We are excited to talk to you about your work and to hear more about sort of your journey in entomology. We're talking about urban pests here today. Morgan, if you were going to talk to folks about urban pests, what would you say kind of falls into that category?
You know, what's funny, as far as entomology goes, this field is super people-oriented. Okay. I find I deal with people a lot more than I deal with the insects, the pests.
So are you trying to say that you think people are the true urban pest, or?
Well, I guess it, from the pest point of view, who is the true pest? But no, my big focus is urban entomology. And in particular, I like studying bed bugs, and because they are one of the biggest challenges that we've come across as far as urban entomology. A big reason is because of, you know, global traveling. People can travel internationally, which means bed bugs, much like a lot of synanthropes, such as German cockroaches, can travel internationally. Due to years, decades of insecticide exposure, bed bugs have been selected for resistance. So a lot of our products that have pyrethroids as active ingredients are just ineffective against bed bug populations now. So they're really hard to kill.
they're tough
to eliminate from a household.
Okay. And as you were saying, they can ride first class or coach. They can go around with us. What was that word you used to describe bed bugs and German cockroaches?
A synanthrope. They basically are insects that interact heavily in a human environment. They live alongside humans.
They like to be with us in our homes. So that's what we're talking about with urban pests. Mike mentioned before we got on the horn here today that he had an interesting urban pest that he kind of wanted to share with everybody. I'm a little nervous about this. But he promises me it will make for good radio. So I'm going to turn it over to Mike for a moment before we dive into you, Morgan.
We're talking about bed bugs for most of today, but I thought this is kind of, it's an urban pest that I've never seen. I have heard of this characteristic for identifying them, but I've never seen it in person. Maybe it's not as exciting for everybody else, but this is a video that a client sent me today. You can see this is the underside of a chair. Hopefully you'll be able to hear it.
The bottom of a chair.
Is that coming through?
Is something chewing?
Those are the rhythmic beats of a carpenter ant.
No, not quite. Dang. They're there.
Is it one of those, like, is it like the old house borer or something like that? Or one of the, yeah?
A death watch beetle.
Yeah.
I think it's a death watch beetle.
That is so cool.
Like, I've heard, like, they're called death watch beetles because, like, you can hear that noise during, like, a wake. You'd have everybody in the house and it's all quiet because there's a dead person. And, like, you can hear the beetles chewing. And I've never, you know, it's supposed to be this really classic way to identify them. And I've never heard it. But, yeah, as soon as I saw that video, I was like, okay, we're dealing with some kind of wood pest. It's a wooden chair. I've heard it described and I've never heard it. But as soon as I did, that's the classic sound that it should sound like from the descriptions I've heard. So
did the client send you like, hey, I'm hearing this sound. What is it?
Yeah.
They had the wherewithal to think that it was an insect in there?
Yeah. So she bought the chair from a furniture company less than 6 months ago. and was sitting in the chair and there's no mechanical parts. And it's like, it's making noise. Why is it making noise? Wow. And she figured out this might be a Death Watch beetle based on the noise, contacted the furniture company and they won't do anything. So she reached out to me asking, like, I need an entomologist's wait to tell them, like, this is their problem because it came from them, which it probably did. It was probably infested when she bought it, and they should, I don't know if legally they need to do anything, but ethically they should probably pay for treatment. And so I said basically all of that, but I'm really hesitant to identify things based, you know, not on an image or a specimen, but I feel like this one, I'm pretty confident just with the noise. And I think it's maybe the first audio identification I've done. So I was really excited, and it seemed like it might fit a little bit for today. So there you go.
Within the realm of urban entomology. And yeah, it does make for good radio. I appreciate that contribution, Mike.
Yeah, that is really cool.
Yeah. Now you've all heard it too.
We have. Thank you.
Hopefully it's not like a curse. I mean, Death Watch sort of implies like, oh, now it's like the Ring. Now we're all going to be haunted by this or something.
So I didn't mean to take us too far off the rails.
We'll get back into it. So like Morgan, it says on your business card, it's the Bed Bug and Urban Pest Information Center, which is also called the Dotson Urban Pest Management Lab. What kind of things go on in this lab? So I know you study bed bugs, but as an urban lab and urban pest, what other things are in there? That's one question, but you're a PhD student and also a research specialist. So are you involved in other people's work too?
Yeah.
So you've got to be involved in a lot of other urban laboratory research, correct?
So how I came about this unique position, I moved from Northern Virginia after working with critter control and to Blacksburg, Virginia, and I was looking for a job at Virginia Tech. And Deanie Miller's laboratory was hiring a research specialist position. So I applied for that job in 2019, and we hit it off during the interview and got along real well. And she ended up hiring me for the position. So from 2019 to 2020, I basically served as a lab technician and the field technician. So we did a lot of sponsored research projects. And around the same time I was hired, Deanie was awarded with a big US HUD grant. And so we were working on a German cockroach study in public housing. So a lot of our field work takes place in, you know, HUD public housing with German cockroach studies. But we also do a lot of laboratory work as well for applied research. So efficacy testing for a lot of pesticides. We work with the big pests right now are bedbugs and German cockroaches. But in the past, Deanie has worked with subterranean termites, carpenter ants, and then suddenly bedbugs took off back in the 2000s, and it basically consumed her life, and now it consumes my life. So from 2019 to 2020, around the time COVID hit, I was encouraged to actually look into Tech's PhD program because I really loved working in urban entomology, even coming from wildlife background. I was accepted into the program. And so now I work full-time as a research technician, but part-time as a PhD student. So I'm juggling all over the place. And now bedbugs consume every minute of my life.
Yeah. And I think when we met, what really sparked my interest in you is that you were like, I love bedbugs. I love them so much. I want to talk about them all the time.
I do. I love talking about them. I would never dream of having them infesting my home, but they are such a complicated little insect. And at the same time, so simple with their, you know, ability to adapt and survive. They live their life in a cryptic environment. They like to live in cracks and crevices of the household, and they are blood feeders. So they use the human as a host and take a blood meal every week. Nymphs need a blood meal to survive, and they go through 5 nymphal stages before they become adults. And once they're adults, they're incredibly prolific. Like, they will have their blood meals and then they mate, and the females will just keep laying eggs And all she needs is just, you know, additional blood meals throughout her life, and she'll continue laying eggs and the cycle will just continue on. So they're very difficult to eliminate. And I am someone who enjoys working with animals, working with people, and problem solving. So I am in a position where I can work with all three aspects of my passion.
Can we unpack that a little bit? I mean, if you're talking about problem solving and things, you've alluded to the fact that they're difficult to deal with and that they're cryptic. What are some of the problems that are presented to people? You mentioned HUD housing, and you're talking about a blood feeding pest. So like, what happens to people when they're confronted with bed bugs? Like, what physically happens to them? And then what are the problems that they try to, that they have to try to solve after they've discovered these little blood stealing ninjas are hiding out in their bed?
The big problem with public housing is that they are married to the idea that if you want to kill an insect, you have to spray and spray and spray. And what are you using to spray? They don't know. Pest control technicians would know, but no one bothers to ask them, right? So it's usually some sort of pyrethroid that's decades old, and it's just not killing the bed bugs like they want it to. So bed bugs have been selected for resistance, and there's three different adaptations basically. So they have reduced cuticular penetration. So they've basically been selected for thicker skins. Then they have enhanced enzymatic activity. So they basically can metabolize these active ingredients out of their systems. So it's the equivalent of getting drunk and then waking up with a hangover and then recovering from that hangover.
That's and an amazing then, analogy. I like that. The idea yes. that, yeah, like you're out on the town taking pyrethroids neat or on the rocks as a bed bug sort of at this point.
And then the third adaptation is the KDR type mutation. So it is a specific mutation in their genes that allows them to just basically shake off pyrethroid mode of actions. So that is basically the gist of resistance with bed bugs. So if you go to public housing, they have pest control contracts. Usually, sometimes they have in-house pest control, which means their own staff will apply the pest control. And then most of the time, they outsource it. They award a contract to a third party, and that third party comes in and applies a treatment. Well, if a salesperson wants to pitch this contract to US HUD, they will usually lowball it for the sake of getting that sale, getting that commission. Because US HUD will always have to award contracts to the lowest responsible bidder for anything. And that includes like plumbing and roofing. But in pest control, you can see the drawbacks to that. So if a salesperson who doesn't necessarily have a background in entomology is able to lowball a contract and is awarded that contract, now it's up to the pest control technician to treat X number of units at the cost of what that salesperson sold the contract for. So usually that ends up being $5 a door to apply a pesticide to treat a house. This is a similar issue with German cockroach infestations as well. So bed bugs and German cockroaches, it usually ends up being the same treatment method. Pest control technician has to be able to enter that unit and spray, put something down, treat it. And I use quotation marks when I say that. And then be out of that unit and move on to the next one in like 2 to 3 minutes. Now, can you imagine? It takes maybe 30 yeah. seconds to a minute to even get through that door.
If it was your own home, how long would it take, you know, if you were to do things the way it needs to be done thoroughly and to treat it properly? How long and how much would that normally cost? I guess if people didn't know that it was more than $5, how much more?
Well, that's actually what we're trying to come up with. So that grant that I had discussed that Dr. Miller was awarded by US HUD, we were basically going in to units, timing ourselves and treating for German cockroaches. And we were using gel baits. And we timed ourselves entering the unit. We timed ourselves basically putting out traps, like low line sticky traps. And we would leave those overnight. And then we'd come back the next day to get the trap catch. So how many German cockroaches did we trap in a single night? And based on that count, we would apply X amount grams of gel bait and time ourselves the whole time. The break even cost for a pest control technician is $1.50 per minute. So you can imagine if you're dealing with a heavy infestation in a unit where we've caught like 500 cockroaches in a single evening on three sticky traps, then you would basically spend 30, 35 minutes in there treating and then multiply $1.50 to that.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, 500 cockroaches on three sticky traps in one night?
You heard me.
that is incredible.
Well, that's the kind of infestations that a lot of public housing is dealing with. My passion is bed bugs, but German cockroaches, I mean, I say are just as prolific, if not more so. They've been selected for resistance as well. Public housing in general is in this mindset where they go in and just spray and spray and spray. And if they can't get rid of that infestation, their fallback is just to basically blame the resident, because the resident doesn't clean up, the resident doesn't prepare. What we're trying to show with Dr. Miller's APM study, which is the Assessment-Based Pest Management Study program, it's similar to IPM in that you can go in and treat these atrociously high infestations and the resident doesn't have to prepare or clean up. Like, we can get rid of these infestations without any resident cooperation.
Wow.
I mean, it feels very much like the government stance is just blame poor people.
It's not just the government. It's the entire country's mindset. You know, blame the resident. If they don't know how to clean up, it's their fault. Mm-hmm. It's their problem. And that's been this way for decades upon decades. It's something that we are trying to stop and force the pest control industry and public housing to move on from that mindset.
So if you can manage them without cooperation from the resident, is it the cost then and the resources that are the limiting factor here?
Yes, it's going to be a little more expensive in the short term. It would be, you know, your $60 a door versus $5 a door, you know, but over time, we're going to see those populations go down. Like onesie twosies to zero in as far as German cockroaches. And then you can go from like this monthly service to a quarterly service where you can just go in and inspect and treat accordingly. And you'll always have these low counts instead of these ridiculous high counts. So it won't be $60 a door. It'll go down to $10, $15 a door.
It's an investment, really. I mean, you're trying to like have this longitudinal effect where, yeah, it's an upfront cost to get the cost lower in the long run. And also to boil it down to just like pure dollars and cents is a little icky to me, I guess, because, I mean, you've talked about cockroaches multiple times. Like, we're talking about higher incidences of asthma and allergies in these places because of the 500 cockroaches on three traps in the evening. Like, just think of all the cockroach feces and exoskeleton bits and everything that are in the air that those folks are breathing. So yeah, it seems like what you're proposing would be a great investment for multiple sectors of human health, right? Like, we bring down all of these incidences, we bring down all of these problems, but in urban, it seems like the big thing is like convincing people of that. I don't know that I can ask you necessarily what's the answer to that question. Like, how do you convince the government that that's a good investment? But I think it's important to bring up that human element, like urban entomology. There's a lot of business to it. Is that fair to say?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, cost is everything. It's what runs things. And it's just a matter of forcing, basically forcing one way or the other to change mindsets. And the biggest obstacle, one of the biggest, is that HUD awards contracts to the lowest responsible bidder. But these contracts are outdated and it's basically my boss, Deanie, is trying to convince HUD to raise their standards.
Gotcha. That's a tough sell for sure. Mm-hmm. Our podcast has slowly become more and more radicalized politically over the last 2 or 3 years. Suffice to say, the forcing part is a hard sell, but yeah, go ahead, Mike.
And I was just going to ask, like, if the bottom line is what they care about, and it, you know, you mentioned there's more upfront cost, but you can bring the cost down over time. Like, I guess, where's the break-even point where if, you know, if you treat the way you should treat, but it's more expensive upfront, like in 6 months, it'll be cheaper. Like, I can imagine, like, there's a line where it's expensive and then goes down versus a flat rate. Like, where does that intersection point? It becomes cheaper to treat the way that you should.
With our APM study that we were working on, and even a study that Deanie did a few years back, we were seeing reductions from 500 overnight trap catch down to 10 to zero within 60 days. And so between 60 and 90 days with this effective treatment, I mean, you will definitely start seeing these results. The cost, well, it does go down.
So like 3 months and it goes down. That's not even that long of a term. Like if you said like, oh, it takes a year, and after a year you start to recoup your costs, like I could see maybe why people would be a little reticent, because that's a long time, but 2 months, 60 days is not a long time.
Another way we're trying to show how to reduce costs is to separate units into categories. So with German cockroaches, we separated units based on the trap catch. So we had low infestations, which is like we trapped between 1 to 10 cockroaches. And then you have medium level infestations, and that's like 10 to 50. Then you had heavy, which was over 50. And then you had super heavy, just like over 500. So if you can categorize these units, you can prioritize the heavier infestations and treat those on a monthly basis, and then treat the lower infestations on more of a quarterly basis. So if you are able to, you know, go abide that timeline, you don't have to treat all of these units at once. You can treat these heavy infestations like during the winter when populations are naturally lower. And then by the time spring comes along, you can start focusing on the lower infestations. And then you'll get to a point where these populations are low enough that you can just treat or even just simply inspect on a quarterly basis.
Like that makes so much more sense to me.
And we use gel baits. So gel baits like Fendenna Nitro or Avion. What Deanie likes to do is cut out Reynolds wax paper squares and fold them.
The tacos.
Like, exactly. So we use the bait taco method, and we just apply a line of gel bait on these cut paper squares that are folded, and we can drop them anywhere in a unit. So another big drawback of applying pyrethroid sprays, these chemical liquids, is that you are limited on where you can treat. So you can't treat like where there's food or personal items like clothing or stacks of mail. And that's where it comes in. If the resident isn't tidy, doesn't clean up, then they can't apply those chemical sprays. And then they just throw their hands up in the air and like, well, the resident didn't prepare. Well, we can take these bait tacos that have gel bait on them and drop them anywhere because they're not in contact with any personal item.
And that's why you don't need their cooperation. And
yeah, they don't need to help us with this. Right. Like we can drop these anywhere in cabinets, pantries, like behind the toilet. You go under the sink, you can drop them where the plumbing is, which is advantageous because that's where German cockroaches spend a majority of their time, near plumbing.
And do they just like love that bait so much that it doesn't matter about sanitation and food, competing food sources?
Exactly. Like they love gel bait. When gel baits first came out several years ago, there was a lot of promise, and then that enthusiasm sort of dwindled out because it showed that cockroaches developed taste preferences. Like there were certain sugars that were in the gel bait that German cockroaches didn't necessarily like. But now there's chemical manufacturers have gotten very good at producing gel baits that are attractive to many different strains of cockroaches. And you have the luxury of being able to rotate different active ingredients out. Different gel baits that have different flavors. Gel baiting is a very advantageous way of controlling a German cockroach population.
Okay, so now I'm going to be like a client or someone that calls. Well, if I can just buy those on Amazon or wherever, why can't I just do it myself?
That's an interesting question. And, you know, I see no problem in a resident being able to do it themselves to an extent. You know, a lot of the gel baits that are available in Walmart are like one type of gel bait, like one particular active ingredient. And if you over apply that insecticide, eventually you will get resistance from that. As far as, you know, a resident treating themselves, I don't discourage it. I mean, I wouldn't encourage it, but I also don't discourage it either. If they can do something better than their own pest control company can do, why not? We are actually going around and training a bunch of different organizations on how to use the APM program. So we actually went down to South Carolina to the Catawba Native American Reservation, and we taught their in-house pest control how to treat German cockroach infestations. And they love it. They are like so excited to apply it. And we're going to, you know, reaching out to pest control companies, and other pest control companies are reaching out to us, and they want to get in on this because they've heard Dr. Miller speak, they've tried it for themselves, and they're finding great results. So they're actually starting to change their mindset as well as when approaching German cockroach infestations.
Yeah.
Which is really exciting.
Yeah, that is. That's good news. And have you seen a lot of these apartments that have both cockroaches and bedbugs?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. When I first started working back in 2019, Deanie's way of on-the-job training was to throw me into the deep end. So we went to Richmond, Virginia, to this house with an elderly disabled woman living in there. And a man who was also a man who was living there with her as well, who was more or less squatting. It was a small house, like 2-3 bedrooms. And we go in, and from floor to ceiling, there's just German cockroaches everywhere. And floor to ceiling, there are bed bugs living alongside them. Like, it was a super heavy infestation from both pests. We could actually open up the seams of their couch, and there would be like German cockroaches sitting on top of bedbug aggregations. It was so fascinating. I felt so bad for the homeowner, but, you know, from a pest control and research perspective, it was very exciting to see. We ended up treating that house with a heat treatment. This one was called Heat Assault. It's this large heating unit that is heats with glycol. So it heats up a house with glycol antifreeze, essentially. So we ended up treating that house for the bed bugs, testing out this new heat assault heat system, and got amazing results. To test these sorts of heat treatments, we bring our own bed bugs from the laboratory. So we have pantyhose, and we fill them up with adults and nymphs and eggs and tie them up so no one can escape. And then we put them throughout the house or an apartment in cold, hard to reach places. And the thermal death point for bed bugs for all life stages, including the eggs, is 122 degrees Fahrenheit. So it has to get really hot. That heat needs to be able to reach those hard to heat areas that bed bugs like to aggregate. So on the floor near the bed, in laundry. And that heat assault did a great job. We ended up getting 100% mortality from our sentinels, our pantyhose bugs that we brought.
How does the heat control like that work? Is it just like a unit that you bring into the house and turn on and it heats it up just the air temperature? Or I guess for the listeners, what exactly is going on when you kill bed bugs and cockroaches that way?
So typically you have a generator. That's the heat system. And there are three different types of heat sources that are most common. So we have propane and electricity and glycol. So these generators are connected to these lines, like Nylar duct tape for propane, or just hoses for the glycol. And they have radiators and fans placed throughout the house that are connected to the generator or the propane system. That generator powers up and heats up, and that heat travels through the house and is dispersed throughout the house with those fans. For electricity, it's something similar. For example, there is a unit called the temp air system, and that is an electric system where a generator powers up big heaters that are placed throughout the unit, and those heaters are plugged into the walls. So using electricity, they end up heating the house that way. The temp air system that I was talking about, that's a relatively new type of heat system. Usually the fallback had been propane or electricity, but this one uses glycol. And it's very interesting because it heats up, the glycol heats up relatively quickly and much faster than, say, propane. It is able to heat up to an even higher temperature. So we're talking like 122 to up over 130 degrees in that house, which is more than effective in eliminating all those life stages of bed bugs.
Heat treatments have always been really cool to me. Like, it's like this holistic way of attacking multiple pests and getting all the life stages. When Jody pitched this episode to us and invited you on, though, she mentioned that you have an interest in a slightly different way of approaching the bed bug control in particular, which is fumigation. Fumigation is not something that I'm super familiar with, just at like a bird's eye level. I know it from when we used to do the urban conference in Nebraska. There was the fumigation category, but it was all about grain bins, seemingly, for people in Nebraska, right, Jody?
Yeah, grain bins.
Grain bins, like they would come in. We just had a few speakers, and it wasn't something they talked a lot about for urban pest control. So you just sort of extolled the virtues of a heat treatment. Why is fumigation an alternative that maybe people should pursue? And then, like, what are some of the research questions that you're asking about fumigation?
To talk about fumigation, I find it very fascinating because it is a very specialized form of pest control. I mean, you have to go through a lot of training and certification to be able to handle these fumigants. Historically, fumigation has been used all the time, constantly, in places like California or Florida, where you have a lot of drywood termite infestations. So fumigation is the way to go for those treatments. It was not necessarily common for anything outside of those warmer states. But as bed bugs have become more and more of an issue, a lot of researchers like Ellen Toms and Brady Sheffron started looking at fumigation for bed bug control. And sulfuryl fluoride is, you know, that active ingredient used for fumigation. There used to be methyl bromide, but that has been phased out. So now basically what we can use in residential structures is sulfuryl fluoride. With fumigation, how effective it is based on the dosage rate. So that is the concentration, like ounces times X number of hours per 1,000 cubic feet. So what that means is if I release a dose of sulfuryl fluoride, X number of pounds, that is gives me a concentration times 6 hours every 1,000 cubic feet, and that'll kill drywood termites. It's complicated to talk about without drawing it out, but basically that's how we measure it, the dosage rate. And with bed bugs, it's actually 1.9 times that of drywood termites. So you have to add more gas or hold it for longer in order to kill all life stages. The big advantage of fumigation, if it's done correctly, if you've reached that dosage factor, is that it is 100% fatal. It'll kill all bed bug life stages. And that brings us back to heat treatments. The big disadvantage of heat is that if you don't reach that thermal death point in all parts of the house, you really cannot guarantee that you have killed the entire population in that unit, because bed bugs have the ability that, you know, they're not stupid. They feel that heat and they are going to escape that heat as quickly as they can. And the eggs are the least susceptible to heat. You know, that 122 degrees Fahrenheit is for the eggs themselves. Adults and nymphs, it requires lower temperatures to kill them in a minute, like 118 degrees. But going back to eggs, they are the most difficult life stage to kill for no matter the treatment you use, fumigation, heat, chemical. So the big thing I'm looking at with fumigation is, you know, bed bugs have not developed resistance to it. So being able to treat these homes, these single family homes, not apartments, you can't, don't want to do apartments, but single family homes is what I'm looking at. Just being able to get rid of these large infestations, helping out homeowners that way and renters.
You mentioned specifically homes over apartments. So help our listeners kind of understand why you have to make that distinction. Like, what is the technology involved in fumigating? And then why can it work for a single home, but not for an apartment complex, perhaps?
So you can fumigate apartments, but here is the issue. Sulfuryl fluoride is very hazardous. Like, it can be very dangerous if not handled correctly. So you can fumigate a single family home and not have to worry about exposing neighbors to sulfuryl fluoride if it's sealed up properly with tape and seal or tarp. But an apartment complex, if you have a unit that has a bed bug infestation, sure, you can introduce sulfuryl fluoride to that particular unit, but you would have to evacuate the entire apartment complex. The whole building would need to be empty of animals and people. And yes, it can be done. And is that economical? Probably not. So my focus, for the sake of simplicity, is single family homes. So there's two different methods of fumigation that I'm looking at. And I'm actually comparing the labor time and the cost of both of these methods. So if you're familiar with drywood termite fumigation down in Florida, they use a lot of tarping. So those big, colorful tarps placed over buildings. And that's the gases released underneath of that. That is not as common outside of Florida and California. What we use in Virginia is called the tape and seal method. So you take painter's tape or a special type of tape and just seal the windows and you seal up the doors and anything that could, where gas could escape from the house, you seal that up with tape and a little bit of tarp here and there. And that is called the tape and seal method. I'm comparing how long and how intensive the labor is for tape and sealing versus covering a whole house with a tarp. I'm also trying to compare the efficacy of doing so. So is the tape and seal method just as effective as tarping for eliminating all bed bug life stages, or is one better than the other? That's what I'm looking at.
What's the cost associated with this? Because, you know, you mentioned the tarp method and that, I guess that's what I'm somewhat familiar with. And that seems expensive. Like you're tarping an entire house. I've heard sometimes you've got to have like security out front to make sure nobody tries to break in while you're gone and die from the fumigants inside. It sounds like something that would be really expensive. How does the cost of it compare to other control methods? And does that make up for it because of efficacy?
In California or Florida, there are a lot of fumigation companies, so there's a lot of competition. So naturally, the cost of fumigation with tarping is pretty low, like maybe $1,000 to a couple thousand for a big house. If you travel farther up north, the tape and seal is a lot easier for a lot of companies to deal with. As far as tarping, a lot of fumigators just don't have that kind of experience. So the cost naturally will start going up to, you know, over $5,000 to $8,000. If there was more competition, different companies fumigating, then that would probably have a lot to do with lowering the cost. But because fumigation is such a difficult business to get into and it's, you know, expensive and it requires a lot of certification, there's just not that much competition in the northern colder states. As far as efficacy, if you achieve that dosage rate, then you have achieved 100% mortality. And that can get rid of all of your target pest in that home quickly, just like that. So it can bring a super heavy infestation down to nothing. Now,
a blank slate.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, speaking of blank slates, the sulfuryl fluoride is a gas. So once you break that seal of a house after fumigation, which means you open everything up, you unseal it, that gas then will escape into the atmosphere. So it leaves the home. That doesn't leave any sort of residual residue for a house. So it will kill all of the bedbugs in that house, but it's not going to stop future bedbugs from reinfesting. So those are other things that you need to keep in mind. But if you look, go back to heat, if you are able to heat treat, and that company does a horrible job doing so, like they never reached that thermal death point or they slept in their truck the whole time, which we have seen, there's just not a chance that they would have been able to make a dent in that bedbug infestation. So that home, that resident is basically back to square one. Their time has been wasted. The pest control time has been wasted. Housing management's money has been wasted. And same for chemical treatments. And, you know, bed bugs are just resistant to a lot of our products that are available for indoor use. So you're basically spraying your money away with each chemical treatment. So it's a big trade-off, you know. Fumigation is the most expensive, but it's also the most effective for insects that are resistant to what we've been using for decades now.
Like them and heat both have the same caveat of you got to check yourself before you go back in, right? Like the homeowner has to make sure when they left for the day to get it treated that they don't have bed bugs hiding out in their suitcase or on their jacket or something, or a cockroach uothica or whatever. It is interesting. I've long been not like skeptical of fumigation. It obviously works, but the infrastructure in northern states seems lacking. And like you said, it's kind of an empty niche. Like maybe more people could pick it up and have a unique business opportunity in front of them if they're a pest control operator.
The big thing that keeps people from wanting to get into that business is, one, you're dealing with a very restricted use product, and it can be very dangerous or deadly if you don't know what you're doing. And there's a lot of liability involved if you don't handle it correctly. So companies have to go through certification. They have to go through training, and they have to have enough certified people to be able to handle this fumigant. And there's other additional factors involved as well. You have to deal with like hazmat and the Department of Transportation to be able to even carry that fumigant around from place to place. So there's a lot of aspects that go into it. One of my big goals is to become an expert in fumigation, to be able to start training and providing expertise to more and more companies who would consider getting into this is another effective form of pest control for bed bugs, at least.
I know people come in and they'll be like, yeah, I had my house fumigated. And I'm like, do they release a gas? So I think people get confused and they don't really understand. So that's why it's like, a lot of it's the education of you're actually treating a space, and it's not a bug bomb. Fumigation versus fogging versus spraying, exterminating, all of those things. If all things were equal, like money didn't have anything to do with it, would you recommend fumigation as the way to go?
Depending on the environment and depending on who is fumigating, yes, I would. You wouldn't believe how often I hear what you had just mentioned, like, oh, I get my house just got fumigated and it turns out they just fogged. So fog is, you know, basically a vapor that will leave a residue behind once it dissipates. And a fumigant is a gas. So it is odorless and colorless, and it will, you know, volatilize into the atmosphere once the fumigation is done. So it is definitely, even if it doesn't leave a residue, it is much more effective than a fog could ever be for bed bug control.
like penetrating into the walls. And that's mm-hmm. why it works for termites and furniture and all those things. Is it safe to release it into the atmosphere?
In low concentrations, yes. There's a low risk of you breathing it in and accumulating enough of a dosage to really affect yourself. The other fumigant that used to be commonly used was methyl bromide. That was commonly used as a residential fumigant, and it's being phased out right now. It's only used for quarantine cases. That fumigant is known as an ozone depleter, according to the EPA. So that's a big reason why it's being phased out. And while sulfuryl fluoride released into the atmosphere does affect the ozone, it's released in a low amount of a concentration for that not to be a concern.
I had one question about tarping versus taping. Does it matter, like, the kind of house that you have? I guess I just thinking about my own house, it's leaky, I guess, for lack of a better word. It is not very, you know, sealed tightly. And even if I were to tape all the doors and windows, like, I imagine gas would just escape out the walls. You know, do houses have to be a certain age, like built in the 60s or newer or 80s or newer or something for taping to be effective? And is there a certain age where, like, you just have to tarp it because it doesn't matter how well you tape it, it's just going to leak out?
Your home, I would definitely recommend tarping. With my study, I am actually going out of my way to look for trailer homes and homes that are, you know, prior 1980s, older homes that have lots of cracks. And the pest control company that we work with, you know, is so loves working with tape and seal because they don't have enough experience with tarping. Some of them do, but some of them don't. So they end up going and taping and sealing trailer homes. They're able to use equipment that can measure the concentration of fumigant in the house, and they can tell if there's a leak. And you better believe there's always a leak with these trailer homes that are taped and sealed. Actually, one of the first houses, or it was a trailer home that we fumigated for my study, was this is an old double-wide trailer that had holes that went from their floor down into the crawl space below, and holes kind of coming out of their wall and holes on their roofs. And we tarped that one. There was no way we could tape and seal that at all. Tarping using the sheets is basically, that is a good way of keeping all of that gas trapped into the home. Now you have to use more gas because now you have a larger cubic footage, larger volume. But if you are able to seal that tarp down to the ground with enough sandbags or water bags, you don't really have much of a chance of that gas leaking out. So it stays trapped in the house, which is exactly what we want. Unlike a tape and seal that if you're not able to seal every crack, then that gas will escape over time. And you have to make adjustments accordingly. So you either need to put more gas in or hold it for longer.
Morgan, one of the things that I thought was really interesting when I met you, you were showing me videos of bed bug eggs. And we've seen a lot of nymphs, a lot of people know about the adults, but there isn't a lot of research on bed bug eggs or embryos. So what can you tell us that we may not know?
So bed bug eggs are really small. They're about a 1 millimeter long. So they are laid in these hard to reach cryptic locations. After a female will lay them, and she lays them individually, not in clutches, like say a stink bug would, but she'll lay the egg. And then 6 to 9 days later, the nymph will emerge. Bed bugs are heavy metabolous insects. So they, during the egg, they undergo blastocinesis, which is when the embryo emerges from the yolk and does this flip. So this flip is called catatrepsis. And I'm happy to show you the video that I made. And the embryo, the head starts on the posterior end of the egg. And about, let's say 48 hours after it's been laid, it's going to do a backflip. And now its head is now oriented towards the operculum, which is the egg cap, which is where the bed bug will emerge. So after it has undergone catatrepsis, it's going to start dorsal closure. So it folds its whole body over the yolk that's inside the egg and basically seals it inside its body. And that's when, yeah, it's really cool. I really have to show you the footage. So it envelops itself over the yolk, and now the yolk is inside the embryo. And that's when the embryo will start developing eyes, start developing its internal organs in the gut. And 6 to 9 days later, it's ready to hatch. So what it does is it starts inhaling air and fluid through its rostrum and starts inflating its little head like a bladder. And it uses that pressure to burst from the egg, pop off the egg cap and emerge from the egg. After that, it's good to go. It hardens up its exoskeleton and it's a cute little first instar nymph. So eggs are pretty good at keeping water inside, so they don't lose too much water. And they don't breathe too much, but they do have pores around the rim of their egg cap called aeropiles. And that's how the egg exchanges air. So it breathes through these aeropiles. So what I'm looking at is basically any changes of the respiratory rate over time from when it's 24 hours old to when that egg is ready to hatch, and see if there is an increase in the respiration rate over time. Because I'm looking at when eggs are most susceptible to insecticide exposure. So if that egg is older and it's breathing more, is there a greater chance for an insecticide like a fumigant to penetrate that egg and affect that embryo?
Gosh, bugs are weird.
Yeah, I'm going to have to show you that video. It does justice. I did not explain it as well as the video would.
We can include it in our show notes so everybody can see what you're talking about there.
Yeah, no problem.
Cool.
The backflip is always my favorite part.
Yeah, it's not often that we talk about acrobatic eggs.
Yeah, you made it sound really cute.
It is cute.
I feel like we've broken ground here. Not often are the words cute and bed bug thrown into the same sentence together.
Have you ever taken a look at a bed bug? They are like a nymph. They are precious. They're so cute.
Okay.
I was like, I'll have to share the story with the bed bug that I called the chosen one, the one that I allowed to feed on me throughout its whole life. But I chose like the one nymph and kept that one nymph alive to adulthood.
Oh, that's awesome. We actually just completed a study where we were counting feces production of bed bugs for each life stage. So we started off, we were measuring for every single life stage. So we needed to start with first instars. So we had some, and we had about 50, hatched them all and fed them all individually on ourselves. So
are you allergic?
Well, I definitely react to bites. It's not pretty. It's very exciting to look at, very rashy, and it sticks around for a few days. Regardless, for the sake of science, I persisted. Although Deanie ended up feeding the majority of them. And basically we kept those bed bugs from first instars, you know, until they all the way into adulthood, feeding them. I got to know them.
Their likes, their dislikes, their hopes, their dreams.
Yep.
In regards to hopes and dreams, you know, what's kind of coming up next for Morgan Wilson, and where are you headed with your project? And are there any places that people can read about it or connect with you online if you would like to share those?
Oh, sure. So I actually moderate our Facebook page and our Instagram page, the Virginia Tech Bed Bug and Urban Pest Research Center. So anyone is welcome to find us and follow us on those two media sites. As far as what's next for me, I'm pretty much just in school right now, but we're doing a lot of networking, and you know, my boss loves going to conferences. She's a fantastic public speaker, and she always makes sure that her students make excellent public speakers, and she likes to get her students out there. So right now it's just a big step of completing my dissertation and getting to know all of these different sources of, you know, the pest control industry. Cause I love this industry so much. I've been in it since critter control. So prior to coming to tech, about 2018, and I could never leave it.
I didn't mean to shortchange Dr. Miller today. I wanted to focus on you. I do know, I mean, Deanie is internationally renowned. She's one of our great extension speakers. I've always appreciated just seeing and hearing her online. I don't know if I've ever seen her in person speak.
She's definitely one of my role models.
She's dynamic. Yeah, she's a role model. I agree with that. But today was about you, not about her. So. But I hope people will find that Instagram and that Facebook page and connect with everything that you're producing there. It sounds amazing. I always like hearing about what's happening at Virginia Tech in regards to urban entomology. If people want to connect with Arthropod online, they can find our blog at arthro-pod.blogspot.com. We are also on Twitter, @arthro_podshow. I am @BugmanJohn on Twitter.
I am @JodyBugsMeUNL.
And I'm @MScavarla36.
And we appreciate Morgan's time today hearing about bed bugs. Everybody go out and look up a bed bug nymph photo and say the first nymph that pops up into your head
of the baby
of that newly emerged nymph. Morgan would say cute is what it sounded like. I would love to hear what everybody else has to think about it. So thanks for tuning in, and we will catch you in another couple of weeks with more entomology goodness.
It's time for our insect heroes to put away their nets and pheromone traps. Join us next time, same bug time, same bug channel, as the Arthropod gang make the world safe from poor insect podcasts. Until then,
keep on bugging.
They are cute.
They are. I agree.
I know. They are just precious when they just emerge from that egg, and they have the little egg cap on their head still. So it looks like they're wearing a little hat, an oversized hat.